Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the next episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. I'm your host, Steve Murphy, retired DEA special agent and 38-year law enforcement professional. If you've seen the Narcos series on Netflix, then you've seen a little bit about my time in the DEA. For our new listeners and viewers on Game of Crimes, a special welcome to you. You've come to the right place to see and hear some of the best true crime content anywhere. Each episode features a guest so you can hear firsthand, real-life, true stories of heroes in action. I'm talking about our law enforcement professionals, our military, and all of our first responders. This is where you'll hear about their dedication to duty, their commitment to excellence, bravery in the face of dangers, and the sacrifices they make to protect all of us. And as an added bonus, you'll occasionally hear from a former bad guy on the show. Now, I know that might sound a little strange, but it gives us all a look from the criminal's perspective, right? And that's what makes Game of Crimes different from so many other true crime podcasts. To all our listeners, thank you all for listening and watching the Game of Crimes. As most of you already know, I'm now posting our guest interviews on YouTube. If you haven't checked that out yet, head on over to YouTube, type in Game of Crimes Podcast in that search bar at the top, see what you think about the show. While you're there, do me a favor, click on that subscribe button, the like button, and feel free to share with all your friends. This little action won't cost you anything other than a minute or two of your time, and it really helps promote the show. Believe me, I know none of this will be possible without your support, and I really appreciate you folks giving me your time. If you like what you're hearing on Game of Crimes, you can get even more content on our Patreon channel. That's at patreon.com/gameofcrimes. There you'll find several bonus episodes each month that cover topics that, you know, you most likely won't hear anywhere else. That's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. So now, let's head over to meet this week's guest. But before we do, you know what time it is. It's time to get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. Welcome back to the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the next episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Can't tell you how much I appreciate you folks coming back. Like I said last week, I don't know what's wrong with you, but maybe we're in the same boat. Maybe that's why you come back and listen to me. You're probably wondering what's wrong with me. But as we always do, we got another fantastic guest this week, an old friend of mine. I love bringing old friends in. It takes us a while to get started in the mornings because we're so busy catching up on, hate to say this, as we get older, we're talking about our ailments, what's hurting on me, who passed away, the things that old people talk about. But today's guest is an old friend. We came on DEA pretty much at the same time back in 1987. And our guest name is Matt Addington. Matt, brother, welcome to Game of Crimes.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. Excited. This is fun. It's relaxed. So let's get rolling.
Well, let's hope after the interview, you and I are still friends. You never know what's going to happen here, right?
You never know, right? It is DEA, you know?
That's it. Don't expect anything.
That's right.
And you can see where this is going to go today, ladies and gentlemen. This is, the things that Matt's done, some of you that know my background, you think I've done something special. Wait till you hear about what Matt's done. I mean, found out something this morning just in our pre-call that I didn't know. So we'll wait and talk about that. But as you know, we have a special section we call Small Town Police Blotter. And before we get into that, I have to give you the disclaimer. This is a show about bad people. This is a show about bad people doing bad things, about bad people doing bad things to good people. We take our show very seriously in our stories, but these criminals, we're going to have a laugh at them every chance we get, right? It's amazing what they can do out there. I hit Matt up this morning just about an hour before we started recording here and said, hey, this is what I do. Would you mind reading the story? And, you know, it took him like a half second to say, I'm in. So I love it. He figured out real quick, you can't make this crap up. So, Matt, I'm going to turn it over to you, brother. Tell us about a stupid criminal that you got here on paper.
Okay, well, let's start with the title that kind of leads us into this. Man stabs wife with fork after burrito assault. That should tell you a lot. Okay. After his wife clobbered him in the head with a half-eaten Taco Bell burrito supreme, a Florida man retaliated by jamming a fork into her hand, according to cops who arrested the couple for domestic violence.
Gee.
So responding to a disturbance call early Tuesday, officers encountered Suzanne Hurlvert, 51 years old, in the Crestview home she shares with Carl Owen Smith, 66 years old. Hurlvert, cops noted, had a fork protruding from her right hand, but was still relatively calm and in good spirits. Hurlvert told investigators that she and Smith had argued about his drinking and that the dispute turned physical. As the couple quarreled, Hurlvert allegedly hit Smith in the back of the head with the Taco Bell burrito. Not just a normal burrito, a Taco Bell burrito. Cops noted...
Burrito Supreme, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The big one. Cops noted that burrito remnants were located on the floor, scattered on the sofa, and on a lampshade. After being hit with the burrito supreme, Smith allegedly plunged a fork into his wife's hand. Now, Smith had been using the utensil to consume a Taco Bell pizza.
Mm-hmm.
The tines were so deeply embedded in Hurlvert's hand that the fork had to be removed at a local hospital. Smith, who was arrested at a nearby bar, and Hurlvert were each charged with felony battery counts. They are both free on $1,000 bond, according to jail records.
A whole $1,000.
$1,000. I would love to be in court to hear that argument.
Oh, my gosh. And of course, I mean, you assault your wife, and the first thing you do is you go to the bar, right? Because cops...
Exactly. And leave her with a fork stuck in her hand.
Yeah, cops will never find you there. Unbelievable. You know, and that's what gets me about these stories, is they're wasting good food. I like taco. Yo quiero Taco Bell.
No, that's... Hey, yo también. Yo también.
I'm good with it. But I can't imagine. I can't even imagine. First of all, I can't imagine stabbing my wife with anything but a fork in the back of their hand. And the second thing I can't imagine is coming back home because, Lorena Bobbitt, you've heard of her?
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right.
Might be Lorena Murphy.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Hey, man, thank you for that story. That's fantastic. I got one here now and just lost it there for a second. And guess what it involves? A Taco Bell burrito. Now, where was that story? Where did that take place?
In Florida.
Of course it did. The reason I pulled up two Florida stories today is because our listeners, you know, I'm in Orlando and Matt's living in Florida also. So we try to keep them in the jurisdictions where we live. But this one, a Florida man yesterday smashed his wife in the face with a Taco Bell burrito. Why waste these good burritos? What's wrong with you people? Causing some to go up her nose. This is according to the police who arrested the suspect on a domestic battery charge. Investigators say that Victor Fosser, 49 years old, got into a confrontation Sunday with his wife inside the couple's home in Parrish. According to a police report, the 49-year-old victim was upset about a family matter and, quote, attempted to seek comfort from her husband. Instead, Fosser went to Taco Bell and picked up lunch. I guess the honeymoon's over. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a good indication.
Returning to the residence with his takeout order, Fosser attempted to give his wife a burrito, holding it in front of her face while making fun of her being upset. The woman then grabbed the burrito and threw it to the floor. Fosser then picks up the rest of the burritos and smashes them in her face, causing some to go up her nose, according to sheriff's deputy. This will explain it all for you. The 6-foot, 335-pound Parrish is currently being held in the county jail on a misdemeanor charge.
So he was hungry. I mean...
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm pretty sure she didn't want to snuggle up to him after that.
I've got the visual on this. It's like, that's a bad visual.
I got to tell you, man, 335 pounds, I can't imagine he'd turn it down in advance from any female. But hey,
wow.
Everybody has their priorities, right?
Right. Oh, exactly.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of Small Town Police Blotter today. Hope you enjoyed that. I love finding these stories and bringing them to you. And actually, I got to be transparent here. On our Patreon channel for Game of Crimes, I have a section every month called You Can't Make This Shit Up. And those two stories were in the episode for August of 2024. But I just thought they were so funny, they warranted being here on the regular podcast. So if you're looking for more stories like that, come on over and check us out on patreon.com/gameofcrimes. Got to get that commercial in there, right?
Of course.
So Matt, so you came on board, let's just say you came on in 1987, which is the same year I came on DEA. What class were you in?
I was in BA 50.
Okay. So you were there when I was in 53. You'd already been there for several weeks when I got there.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, that's when I think we had five classes.
Yeah, you probably went to our graduation.
Probably did.
Yeah.
And just sit there looking like you know what?
That's right. We were out of prison. So,
yeah. But before we get into all your background with DEA and the other things that you've been involved with, just this is the way we start with all of our guests. Tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, your family dynamics, brother, sister. I know you played some sports, and I'm going to brag on you if you don't. So I'm just giving you a heads up. And where you went to college, and you just get us started that way.
Sure. So I was born actually in the beautiful city of Fresno, California. Okay. Back in the day, it was actually kind of a rough town. But when we were very little, we moved to McLean, Virginia. So I was really young when we left Fresno, and went to school there, private Catholic school. I've got a brother who's about 8 years younger. I have a sister who's about 4 years older than me. We all went to St. John's, McLean, Virginia, and went on to Bishop O'Connell High School, where soccer was my life. I had a soccer ball I carried with me every morning. I think I even slept with a soccer ball. Yeah. That's how crazy I was about soccer. And it was really just emerging at the time. It was in most of the universities and stuff, but it wasn't as big as it is now, of course, but it was getting there. So at O'Connell, I did pretty good in soccer, and was an All-American, Parade Magazine, National Coaches, and Adidas All-American, which I was proud. I had worked hard, but like you said,
what position did you play?
I was a striker. Yeah.
Nice.
I was a forward. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I was a goal scorer, and I never wanted to play any other position, which is, I've got a little funny story about that. And then I was on the part of the Olympic development program and was at a camp for that. And Coach Joe Maroney from the University of Connecticut was there watching players, and they had won the national championship.
Wow.
Division I that year. So I just happened, call it luck, call it timing. He was watching a game that I was in at the camp, and I hadn't scored 3 goals in that environment in my life. And I had a really good game. And he walked up to me and he said, you're coming to UConn. Okay. And I was like, and I'm saying to myself, UConn, I don't want to play in Alaska. I had no idea about college soccer in my head.
Yeah,
he goes,
yeah.
The University of Connecticut would be proud to have you. And I'm like, oh, okay. Now I get it. So not the sharpest tool in the shed, but, so I ended up going to UConn as a freshman, and very intimidating actually, going into that environment, because since they won the national championship, where every single player recruit there, all 22 or 23 recruits, not mentioning the team that was returning, were all the best players in the country.
We had
6, I believe, if I remember correctly, there were 6 high school All-Americans that had been recruited to UConn, and
wow.
I was one of them. But things worked out for me, some luck, some fate, and I ended up being the only starter as a freshman on the team, which was exciting. And I went on to have a good 4 years, and I was the captain of the team and an All-American in college, and still hold, I think, my name still in the record book somewhere. I don't say any of this to gloat. I say it as more of a premise to, I worked hard at it, and I'm proud of my accomplishments. You know, keep them to ourselves until we have to expose them here or you read about them. But I was proud of that. And that actually really helped lead me into this whole DEA environment. because knowing what dedication and hard work does, not to be sappy, but the reality is I think it takes a certain mindset, as you know, to come into DEA and to thrive and do well and be successful. You really have to be maybe even a little off, but you really have to be dedicated to a cause greater than yourself and
and
be a team focused person and all of those type of things.
You're not bragging on yourself, because if you hadn't brought it up, I was going to.
I've got my notes right here in front of me. But, so I figured I would just say it.
But it's the other thing is you have the ability to focus on a mission, and that and at that time soccer was your focus, right?
That's right.
As well as your academics, but you follow through, and so I've got four kids, two boys and two girls. My oldest son and my youngest daughter both played soccer from when they were very small. The son got a soccer scholarship to go play in a small college in West Virginia, did real well, played midfield. Our youngest daughter played up through high school as a striker. She's our adopted daughter from Medellin, Colombia, has this natural speed. And you'll love this because you know who I'm getting ready to talk about here. She was the fastest kid. Nobody could catch her on the field until she played against Ava Cooper Davis's daughters. They were phenomenal. That's Monica, and I can't remember the other one's name. But, you know, our daughter, Mandy, was used to just screaming down the field, and people were always chasing her, and Ava's daughters were passing her.
Yeah, so Ava and I would cross each other every now and then and you know, see each other in the grocery store and things, and we talk about that. The incredibly talented soccer players. Both my daughters played soccer too, and one of them went on to Georgia State on a full soccer scholarship.
Nice. So
she's now 26, and the other one's my other daughter, Jordan, is 25. So, and they're both doing very well, and you know, committed to, you know, causes greater than themselves, which I like.
Excellent.
But working hard.
And for our listeners, Ava Cooper Davis was a special agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration. I worked for her. She was my ASAC at Special Operations Division for a while. And then she was the special agent in charge of the Office of Special Intel when I was promoted up to SES, and I took her slot. Let me tell you, that was big shoes to fill. I think the world to her. She moved over at that time to be the special agent in charge of the Washington Division office.
I feel the same way. An amazing person. Amazing person. Smart. Hardworking, committed, says it like it is. Always enjoyed her guidance and being around her. There's a lot of, we could go through a list of names, right?
Yep.
Of just really, really good people.
That's why I like bringing, you know, retired DEA guys on here, because we get to talk about people we haven't talked about in a long time. She is absolutely a person that I think the world of. I just have the utmost respect for her. Now, did you graduate from UConn?
I sure did. Yeah, I graduated and went straight into, there was a little lag, but basically went straight into the DEA. So I was very young.
Did you major in criminal justice? Or what was your major?
No, I was a communication science major. But there is a family tie to this, because my father at the time had a very large counterterrorism training center he ran domestically in the United States.
Really?
And it was private, but they trained a lot of foreign embassy security folks and some intel folks there. They'd come over from all different parts of the world and train at the center. It was, I can't remember the name of it actually, but it was in Louisiana. It would do bomb render safe training, shooting, driving, all of these things. But that led him, he had obviously a tie to the intelligence community, and had also worked with an individual named Bill Cronin, who at the time had been the deputy director or the director of the FBI crime lab, I believe was his position at the time. So there was all this discussion about what I should do when I graduate. Should I go into the FBI or should I go to the DEA? And at the time the FBI was not hiring. You had to be 25 in order to apply to the FBI. And so I applied to the DEA and beat that time and got in. So I went through the interview process. It was a process. I don't know what it's like today, but it wasn't that easy back then.
No,
it was very grueling. The interviews and
it's, I don't think it's anything like it used to be, although now you do have to go through a polygraph and a psychological. And if we'd had to do that back then, I'm not sure I would have got the job.
No, that's right. That's right. But I had to do that with what we'll talk about with the agency, with the CIA.
Yeah.
My CIA time. I've got some good stories about that.
Well, when you mentioned that your family moved to McLean, now, what agency is located in McLean?
Right. Exactly.
CIA.
Yeah, that's right. Down the street.
Yeah. That is, and I didn't know there was a connection there, but wow, I didn't know that background about you.
Yeah, well, we used to laugh, too, in high school at Bishop O'Connell. So many kids, you'd ask them what their dad did or their mom or whatever, and you'd always get either, they work for State Department, or I have no idea what they do. Then you're like, okay, another government person. It's the only place in the world you can live and operate and bump into so many intelligence people and special agents and stuff, and you just don't have that anywhere else in the country.
We lived both times that we were in station and headquarters or headquarters elements. I never, thank the good man upstairs, never had to go into the building to work in the building. But we were out in Ashburn. And Ashburn is out where Dulles Airport is, Loudoun County. And we refer to it as the Fed ghetto out there. I mean, almost everybody, they're either a government employee or they're a contractor that works with the government.
That's right.
And here's an interesting story. So we all saw Trump, the attempted assassination there in Pennsylvania. The really big, tall agent behind him, his face is very prominent, lived across the street from us. That was Sean.
Wow.
I won't say his last name on here, but
wow.
And I think he's probably moved on from living there. So don't go looking for him, people.
Yeah, right. That's interesting.
Then we heard after that several Secret Service agents were put on leave. And I didn't see Sean on TV for a couple of weeks, but I just saw him here this past week. So he's in good graces and still... I mean, a fantastic man, family man, doing his job for his country and protecting, whether you like Trump or not, he was our past president.
And guess what? Great agency, Secret Service.
They are.
Phenomenal people. We all know, like you, I know so many Secret Service agents I've worked with. And between as investigators or protection, they're phenomenal. Just phenomenal.
Was there a lapse there? It certainly sounds like it. But when you politicize it, all common sense seems to go out the window when you add politics to it. So,
that's
on the show here. We stay apolitical, and we're not going to talk any more about that.
That's right.
But so how old were you when you applied for DEA?
My exact age. Geez. So it was...
I guess it'd be 21 anyway, right?
Yeah, I was 22. I guess I was 22, 23.
Wow.
Maybe 23.
Were you the youngest in your class?
Myself and I think Misha Piastro.
Remember
Misha?
Yeah, yeah.
I always say Misha and I get corrected. Misha Piastro.
I always call him Misha too.
Yeah, great. One of the greatest people I've ever met in my entire life.
Yeah.
The whole crew, that's our snowcap crew, you ended up with him. But he was, I think he might have been the same age. We both were really young. But yeah, we were definitely, because the average age of our class, I want to say was like 31.
Well, 32. So you were in 52. You were in 50. I was 53. I was the second oldest guy in my class. I turned 32 while I was in the academy.
Wow. Wow. But that's great because it's guys like you that brought in all the experience that we had to lean on because we didn't know.
I think they want to bring a couple of, it's not 31, 32 is not old, but
no,
they want you there to try to calm down the younger ones. They're like, yeah, let's go party.
That's right. That's
right.
Of course,
we might have been the one driving them all over to Lunga Reservoir there for a keg party every once in a while, but...
That's right. Those things will happen. Those things will happen.
Do you remember those days?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well,
one thing that every DEA person that comes on here, I ask them a question. While you're in the academy, did you ever have to write any memos? Well, he's thinking.
I did not.
Really?
Well, and you know why? I had a very, very unique individual assigned as our group counselor. You know how they bring in three agents from the field and they have to be counselors. I'm not going to use any names or anything like that, but our counselor had been sent there for reasons unknown to us from New Jersey. The first thing he said was he grabbed a couple of us who he took kindly to us, myself and another agent specifically. And he said, listen, he goes, this is the thing. Don't bother me. He goes, do your paper, do your reports, give them to me. I'll review them. I'm not giving them back to you. He goes, assume if you don't get them back, they're fine. And so from there forward, We would turn in our paper and we never got a thing back. We got left alone. We kept our mouth shut. We stayed disciplined and low key, which is the game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And let all these strange characters in the class get destroyed and hammered and knocked out during training. You had one guy who was just needed to go and he got knocked out in the boxing and he left. So, but yeah, it's,
wow.
I did not have to do any memos, but people did. People did have to do memos.
I had to write a few.
But I had a unique counselor. I don't think anybody in our little group had to write a single thing if they didn't want to.
Now, do you remember who your class coordinator was that's assigned to the academy? Herb Warren.
Herb Warren.
That was mine also.
It was Herb Warren.
Yes,
it was. What a great guy. What a calming, unless you irritated him.
Yeah.
Taking care of business, right?
Yep.
I remember the comment.
That and the other one was, to be on time is to be late. To be early is to be on time.
That's right. That's right.
And
just,
you know what?
Take care of business. Take care
That's
of
it.
Business.
I know. And that kept a lot of us out of trouble, too, because you knew, especially, you know, you did PT in the morning and then you're out there for 2 hours and you're sweating like a dog and you got to take a 2-minute shower, get dressed and get up to the classroom. Wow. But those were words of wisdom from Herb. And I ended up working for him. He was my ASAC in Atlanta years later.
Oh, that's fascinating. Wow.
Yeah,
it's interesting, too, at the academy. Everybody had their what they were good at, right? You had, like me, I was lucky. I was come out of soccer, right? Division I soccer. The PT aspects were, you know, challenging for a lot of people. For me, it wasn't that challenging in a sense. I mean, pull-ups are still difficult for me to do. But, you know, you had people that were great shooters, though. I was a good shooter, not a great shooter. And academics, well, I think everybody did pretty well in the academics.
Yeah.
At least in my class. But
well, you got to remember, everybody's a college graduate, you know, so everybody's used to taking tests.
Yeah.
But not everybody always passes those tests. It's amazing.
Oh, that's true. That's true. It was always a little bit of a shock if you didn't, right?
Yeah.
If somebody didn't, you'd be like, wow.
I would just look at them and thinking, because they had us set in an alphabetical order, so I'm towards the back of the room up in the, we had those stacked rooms.
Yep.
And I'm looking at those people like, you can't be that simple. This isn't hard.
Right. Right. They want you to get through, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
They want to challenge you, but they want you to be successful.
Yeah. So when you, when it came time to preparing your wish list, what was on your wish list?
It was interesting. So Miami was number one because I wanted, that's one of the things I took into the job. I don't know what other people take in. That's for them to talk about. For me, I always throughout my career, and it started right there, I always wanted to do everything that would be considered top of the game in a sense. The mission's important no matter where it is, but I put Miami down, got the other, New York. Didn't put New York because I didn't want to go to New York.
Yeah.
There I just, you know, New York is for New Yorkers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Boston is for Boston.
Boston
people. I used to love that too. Agents would spend their whole careers who came in from New York or Boston trying to get back to New York and Boston.
Yep. They loved it. They loved it.
But I don't remember. I think I put LA. We only had big divisions available to us really at the time. Miami, LA, and I think Atlanta was my third.
Yeah.
So when I pretty much knew I was going to get Miami because they had a lot of openings. Mm-hmm. We knew they had a lot of openings there. And a lot of people in the class didn't want to go to Miami. At the time, it was still the wild, wild west down there. And but I had, you know, I did not have a family at the time.
It was, I tell you, I put on, I think our counselors told us, look, just put one major division down and you can put out whatever you want on there. So I put down Norfolk, Virginia, Wilmington, North Carolina, Charleston, South Carolina, Jacksonville, Florida, and then Miami was my division. And of course, Murphy's Law being what it is, you're going to Miami.
That's right. Yeah.
But what a blast, wasn't it? I mean, it was so exciting to get down there.
It was incredible. We had five people from my class go to Miami.
Wow.
Matter of fact.
Who else went down there with you?
Jay Bergman.
Yeah.
Misha. No, I'm sorry. Misha did not go to Miami. Don't remember the names of the other guys because I was so tight with Jay Bergman down there. Matter of fact, we were roommates when I first got there.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. So we remained friends. And our careers, it's interesting, kind of paralleled each other for promotional purpose, supervisor, ASAC, and SES timeframes were all kind of parallel. It was very, it was kind of funny. We tracked that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's, well, you remember Dave Gaddis.
Oh, of course.
I had Dave on the show here probably a year ago. And although he had been on the job, I think a year longer than we had, our careers kind of paralleled each other. He would get promoted and then I get promoted and he'd get promoted and I get promoted. And it went like that till the end, believe it or not.
It's funny. I worked for Dave twice. He was the ASAC in Charlotte when I was the RAC in the resident agent in charge in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yeah.
And then in Columbia, we overlapped for a short period. So that was, I mean, and he was, it's interesting. He's one of those leaders that I respected his intensity and his commitment. Because if you didn't, things weren't going to go well for you.
Yeah.
You know, you really needed, and he demanded a lot. And I respect that. And I needed that. You know, I thrived under that. So I love Dave. I thought Dave was just an outstanding leader in the agency.
He is. And you know, for a leadership principle, your leader needs to tell you what's expected of you.
That's
if he doesn't, you're just going to flounder around doing what you think is right. But the thing is, everybody else is going to flounder around doing what they think is right.
That's
one of the principles of leadership is you tell, I don't mean to call them subordinates, but the people that you work with, they need to know what is your focus and what's the ultimate goal here we're trying to achieve.
That's right.
So I love it. And he was, he's the kind of guy too, that would support his troops to the fact that he would get them what they needed to do the job. I think the world of Dave is just.
1,000%. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Good man. Good man.
Yeah. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
So you get to Miami. What group are you assigned to down there?
So this is interesting. I felt so privileged to go to the Florida Joint Task Group, which at the time it was the vice president's Florida Joint Task Group. So I was actually, my first supervisor was a customs supervisor, Neil Himes. And we were a mix of U.S. customs agents and DEA agents. And I think we might have had some INS, immigration.
Immigration
agent. But what a phenomenal experience for a new agent to come in. I was signed to international smuggling. So we worked the ports. We worked the airport. We took all the leads that would come in from overseas, from assets, using the word assets, from confidential sources that would say, this woman's coming in with a suitcase and she's got 2 pounds of cocaine hidden in the lining. We got a tip from somebody and we'd go to the flight. We'd quietly approach and then check, boom, we'd find it. And back then, I don't know if it's true today, but back then what was so much fun was if she was doing a connecting flight, like a lot of times it was to New York, they'd come into Miami or they'd go out to LA or Boston, you would literally uncuff them. Most of them would cooperate, these individuals, because they were mules, and you'd find out where it was going, who it was going, who their contact number was. They usually had a phone number they were supposed to contact. And of course, you had to execute this operation that had so many layers because you don't know if there's surveillance on the airplane with her. You don't know if there's surveillance when she walks out of the airport or when you go to the connecting flight. You don't know. So it becomes a big undercover operation. But you get on the plane with her, take the dope, and fly up to New York. The agents from New York would meet you. You'd go do a controlled delivery. She'd make the phone calls necessary for the pickups. And probably 75% of the time it worked.
Yeah.
That died out because I believe because of prison talk. Everybody like lifting the trunk, right? As the signal, take a case down. Same thing, right? Eventually it came to the point where the bad guy, if you were undercover, he'd say, just don't go to the trunk, please. Yeah. Don't open the trunk. But it worked and we had a lot of fun. We went to LA, we went to New York, Boston, all over the country doing controlled deliveries. And then worked the ports and those would spin into some bigger cases. So we got a great education process. I'll tell you one funny story though about the Florida Joint Task Group. I was a brand new agent and we were so down on special agents. When I came in to the Florida Joint Task Group, I was partnered with another DEA agent and we both were brand new.
Oh, we don't know anything.
Wow. And it was like, he was like, go out and do your job that you were trained to do. We're like, okay. So, you know, we worked with, we had some agents in there, some customs agents who were phenomenal. They'd been on for many years, took us under our wing and showed us, you know, kind of the border search and all that. But we got called to the airport once. There was this, at the time, they were seizing airplanes, U.S. Customs, commercial flights.
Yeah.
And so we get called to the airport because the cleaning people had found coke under the seats on a 747 of a flight that had come in from South America. So we go out there. Now, the flight's been unloaded with all the people. There's 375 people waiting to get on the flight, carry on. So we get there and there are like record albums with coke with about an inch thick of pure coke base under like 200 seats. So we have to go around and we have to collect all the coke or whatever. And so I call up my supervisor, customs supervisor. I said, well, listen, we found all this coke and you know, what do we do? He goes, that's an internal conspiracy. He goes, seize the airplane.
Was this Avianca?
No, it was Eastern Airlines at the time.
Oh, okay.
I said, it's a 747 waiting to go somewhere. He goes, so? He goes, if there's reasonable suspicion that it's an internal conspiracy that involves employees, we seize the aircraft and they have to pay the $1 million fine or whatever it was to get the aircraft back in service. I said, well, what do I do? He goes, well, call up the set, you know, the cargo enforcement team guys, have them bring some stickers, orange stickers that say property of the U.S. government, go into the cockpit and tell the pilot to put it up on the window and they'll tow it to the seized lot. I'm literally saying to myself, you're kidding me. I'm about to seize a commercial airplane. So the best part is though, I go to the gate agent and I said, I've just been advised. Now we're in jeans, mm-hmm. T-shirt. Yeah. I got long hair, mm-hmm. partner. I have my little badge around my neck. And I said, well, we're going to seize the airplane. So it's going to be out of commission. I said, so you need to tell everybody to, you know, whatever you need to tell them to get another flight.
Yeah.
And she goes, I'm not telling them. He goes, you're telling them. You're the government. You're seizing the plane. I said, you want me to tell them?
All right, I'm put like, them what on do you want phone. Me to
say? I'm like, she goes, I don't know. That's your problem. So I grabbed the mic and I said, oh, ladies and gentlemen, you know, this is Matt Addington, today's special agent. We're seizing the airplane. And of course, commotion, news. Everybody, 300 people booing me. Boo. I'm like,
this is back in the time we got a revolver and you're thinking, I've got six rounds in here and there's 300
right.
of them.
That's right. And this was, you know, this is 1988, right? So, yeah. I mean, and that's what they did. They took it over. They paid $1 million fine within like 3 hours and it was released to go back in service. And this was happening. This happened a lot because, you know, we had those cases with baggage mm-hmm. handlers. Remember the American Airlines? I think it was mm-hmm. American. I can't remember where they had the baggage handler scandal and things of that nature. So,
wow. Yeah.
Crazy.
Now, here's this kid's been playing soccer, just having fun playing soccer, going through college and enjoying life and chasing girls. And next thing you know, he's seizing a 737 or 727. Or 747. There you go.
No, it was a monster. No, exactly. Wow. I was like, it was crazy.
Welcome to DEA, brother.
Yeah. No, exactly. Exactly.
It was outrageous. I'm going to tell you just a really short story. When I joined DEA, I'd already been a cop for 12 years. The most powder cocaine I'd ever seen was a little baggie of 2 ounces. Got to Miami in late 87, did an undercover with Gene Francoeur in early 88, went to the Turks and Caicos Islands and picked up 400 kilos. So we went from 2 ounces to 880 pounds of coke. And you know what? I was addicted to cocaine at that point.
Yeah.
Just in a different way.
That's right. That's right.
It was so exciting down there.
It was crazy. It's funny. I'll kind of do myself with this quick story.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were, you know, we're hitting. And now I had moved into an enforcement group. Right. And we're doing a classic warehouse case. 18-wheeler goes into the warehouse, opens up. We've got informants. We get the bus signal. We go. Now, I'd been given for the first time, I had a pistol grip shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And my job was to go to the back of the truck to get the guys that were throwing the coke, the bales of coke out of the back. You know, two of us were going to go back there. And then everybody had an assignment in the warehouse when we hit the warehouse.
Uh-huh.
And so I've got this pistol grip shotgun, right? And I go around the back. And of course, these guys, nobody speaks English. And I'm like, no, same way. And I rack. And I was told this brand new, relatively new agent. I was told, just rack the shotgun. Everyone will stop in the back of that truck. Trust me. Uh-huh. So I'm like, I get so excited. I rack it like four times and I'll go four rounds. I heard about that for a while. Oh,
I'm surprised I never heard about that.
Man, that was I have to do myself. That was classic. So,
what the bad guys do?
Oh, they did stop. They did freeze, and one of them peed his pants. So it had the effect that it needed to have. But
you know what? We used to joke around that if the public only knew, they wouldn't believe the things that go on.
No, there is.
And it's an honest mistake. I mean, you're relatively new and somewhat inexperienced at that point.
Yeah, yeah. It was classic.
Thanks for that story, man. That's not that I'll ever forget about that one.
Yeah, no, right? Right? Yeah, I can do myself now, right? I kept that one quiet for a long time.
Really. Yeah. Yeah, it might go in the DEA rumor mill. No, I wouldn't do that.
No, that's right.
I wouldn't
do that. That's right.
So you went from what enforcement group were you in Miami?
Went from 23, a Florida Joint Task Group, to Lauderdale, to Tony Placido. Okay. Yeah.
Placido was the ASAC?
No, he was a group supervisor then.
Man.
He was really my first real DEA supervisor.
There's a hero.
Yeah. Oh, no.
There is a stud.
Tony, I owe so much of what I learned about the agency, about doing investigations. I did undercover there, and did some undercover. And Tony was just a great leader. He was phenomenal for me. And then he did me even a bigger favor, is he assigned me to the Broward task force. Mm-hmm. So I was the only DEA special agent assigned to a task force in Broward that had all the county's narcotics guys from Sunrise, from all these various Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood.
Plantation, all the little towns. Yeah.
They all were under one roof, the narcotics guys. So I was running and gunning with these guys, and they were doing massive cases, even as locals. But we did it in task force. So I brought money. I brought, you know, some technology and capability, you know, listening and things of that, you know, Title III and a lot of capabilities. But here I was running and gunning with these guys every day and every night.
Yep. That's adventure, I mean, man. That's I'd love that.
Yeah, testifying in court. I mean, every week I was in court.
For something. And those kind of things are where you actually learn the ins and out of the job. You really learn how to do it. You're doing everything that out there, whether it's 500 kilos or smaller case, a kilo here and there. And you know, in South Florida back in the 1980s, there was dope everywhere.
That's right. That's well, even Lauderdale. In Lauderdale, we were doing. I mean, half of our cases were out of Miami.
We used to bitch about the guys in Lauderdale coming down to Miami, coming down to Dade County.
Oh, I know, Metro Dade Narcotics. Of course, we know what happened to a couple of those guys we were working with.
Oh, that's another story.
That's another story. But we were running and gunning in Kendall and Miami. Alvamini was the ASAC, if you remember correctly. And he was, talk about aggressive.
Yeah.
He's like, get your ass down there and get it done. It was no.
I had Tony on the show back in July of last year, of 23, in episode 106, if anybody's interested. I mean, that guy, when Michelle, the administrator, Michelle Linhart, promoted me up to SES, she said, I'm putting you over. And that's when I took over Ava Cooper Davis's position at the Office of Special Intel. And I told her, I said, Ava, the words Murphy and Intel don't go together in the same sentence. That's just, I'm ops.
Right.
And she's like, no, get your butt up here. I go to the 12th floor my first day, and Tony's head of Intel at the time. He's like one of the number threes there in all of DEA. And I get off the elevator and I'm trying to figure out which way to go. And I look, and he's out talking to his secretary, and he turns around, and he goes, Murph! And he comes up and gives me a big old bear hug, picks me off of my feet. And that's the way the relationship went after that. I just think the world of that man.
Yeah, I can't say enough. It's actually really personal to me, the mentorship that he gave me. He's another one that I truly believe. Him and Jim Kibble are probably two of the most influential individuals I ever worked with or around or for in DEA.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I don't mean to tell my story on your show here, but
no, it's great.
I was, because in the office I had, there was a lot of classified programs in, but I had to do a lot of travel. And so I would come, I'd make appointment like once a week, go up to meet Tony, and this is what we're doing. This is what's going on this week. And by the way, I'd like to travel here and here. And I just need you to sign off. And after about the third or fourth time doing that, he said, just stop a minute. He said, who's in charge of the Office of Special Intel? And I said, well, you are. And he's like, no. Who's the director out there? And I said, I am. He said, if you determine you need to travel to do the job, go do your travel. you don't need my permission. You're an SES now. You're the special agent in charge out there. And it's ingrained in us so much as working agents coming up the ranks that you got to get somebody's permission.
That's right.
Yep. And that's, you know, but the man put the trust in you to do your job, and you just, you can't always find a person like that.
No, that's it. It's interesting too, is a challenging but incredible boss that I had was Rod Benson.
Mm-hmm.
And when he did the same thing with me when I became an SES, he was head of Intel. And he did the same thing with me. I had profound respect for that. He challenged me, but at the same time, he made me better at my job. But he said, Matt, he goes, you're the boss. Make the decisions you need to. You don't need my permission.
Yep.
So he gave me a lot of leeway.
Yeah, I met Rod when he was an ASAC and SOD when I was a staff coordinator. And then I worked for him when he became the SAC of Atlanta. And then I worked with him when he was the head of Intel for DEA.
Right. So the twins, the brothers.
Yeah. Rod and Russ. Yeah.
Russ. I'm sorry, Russ. It's not Rod. It was Russ.
Russ. Yeah. Okay. I worked for Rod.
Yeah. Yeah.
Different people. So,
yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. But just outstanding, intense individuals.
Yeah.
Very committed. Great patriots.
So now you're in Fort Lauderdale and you got involved in a special operation, didn't you?
Oh, when I snow cap. I'm sorry. I jumped ahead because actually I was doing snow cap still while I was in Miami. I got transferred up to Lauderdale. So yeah, you know, paramilitary operations we were doing in South America. And at the same time, there was Cadence, which was just really snowcap, but in Central America. So I actually did you did 90-day tours with your team. Before that, you'd go to training. We went to what we call a modified U.S. Army Ranger school because we did not have the desert phase. They pulled that out. And it was very, very specialized. And then we did Jungle Operations Training Center, JOTC, in Fort Sherman, Panama, went through that course. And then we stayed there an additional like 10 days. I can't remember how long. I think it was about 10 days or 2 weeks. And we had the 7th Group came in, SF 7th Group, and did some very specialized waterborne operations and some more night navigation and tracking in the jungle. And it's very intense jungle there in Panama.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk about learning a lot. And that was what I call that, because we had already been through Ranger School. We didn't need to be yelled at and deprived of food or whatever. That was really a professional school. Very difficult, because the navigation, the land navigation aspects of that school in Panama were crazy. And of course, got to tell a story. Of course, they say, listen, here's the navigation range. They give you the maps. You've been trained in the terrain and everything in navigation. You've taken the courses, they've taught you how to do the math, right? And do the steps, how to navigate where you need to go.
Right.
So they say here in Panama, this area here in the middle, this is very dangerous territory, heavy swamp, thicket. If you get in there, you're not coming out. It's off limits, big red thing, off limits. But course, if you look, and they said there's always a group that thinks they can do it because it cuts your time in half.
Oh yeah,
to get to points.
Shortest distance, 22 points is a straight line.
And they said, don't do it. But they said, listen, what we're going to do is we're going to give you each, you're going to have a flare, and you're going to have a radio, of course, and you're going to have a flare. So what'll happen is if you have an emergency, nothing to do with the red zone, they don't expect you to go in there. Somebody gets hurt, breaks a leg or something, because you're out in the middle of the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you will hit us on the radio. You will give the following call sign. We will then put people up in the towers. They have massive towers in like 4 or 5 locations throughout. This is a massive range, right, in the jungle for training. And then we'll tell you to hit the flare so we can locate
you. Find you, yeah.
It's not, people weren't wearing GPS trackers back then, right, or cell phones and all that. So never fails. One of the groups decided they were going to cheat, cut through. Of course, we all did the course, came back. Where's that other group? Where's that? So they had to muster, the SF team had to muster themselves to go out and retrack to find them, because one, their radio died, and two, they hit their flare without a radio, because the radio had died, hoping that somebody would see it. There were no one in the towers, so they had to find them, and they did, brought them back, and they tried to cut through the thicket, the swamp thicket, and got stuck, literally water up to your chest in mud, you know. So lesson learned, right? Don't try and cut corners.
not to mention all the critters that are out there.
Oh, I don't even want to, the ants, the spiders, you'd have bugs crawling down you in the middle of the night doing navigation, you know, and of course they say also don't fall off the cliffs because you're going to die.
Oh, thank you.
It's like pay attention to your maps and because you can't see at night and you have to be tactical. You can't use any lights, right? The whole thing was just, it was very intense, but it was incredible training. We were well-trained machines. We were trained in explosives, C4, cratering charges, you know, det cord with blasting caps and all of that, and how to do it safely, how to blow things up and small weapons, large weapons. We even got to shoot some rocket-propelled grenades.
Cool.
M79 grenade launchers we carried. We were outfitted well, and then we deployed into country in teams of like 10 or 12. We were the Eagles.
Mm-hmm.
My tours were mostly under Jim Kibble. I did one with Gino Bachman.
Oh, yeah.
If you remember Gino and his team.
Yeah, very well. Yep.
And big prayers for Gino. He's battling some health issues. So,
yeah.
God bless him. But Jim Kibble was really, he ran our team, the Eagle team. And of course we had jokes in the camp. Like the other team were the Badgers and we were the Eagles. So we'd do our 90 days and then Gino's team would come in. And of course we came back after they had been in camp and we had written Eagles signs all over the place. Well, they put bees in front of all the Eagles. So we were now the Beagles. When we came back in, so it was funny. We had a good balance of play between the two teams and stuff, but they were intense operations. People always ask, like, what did you guys do? And they were your classic counter-narcotics, narco-terrorism type cases where you get intel about where a lab might be or where money might be delivered, on aircraft on these covert landing strips. So, you know, we'd go in a day early and we'd set up and we'd wait for the plane to land and we'd assault it, take down the dope and the money if it was there. The labs, we'd do the same thing or just literally hunt down labs, drop into villages, go through villages that we knew were narco supported.
Yeah.
They would be stockpiling drugs and things. They were, and then we would blow everything, which, you know, of course,
this was the fun part.
So much C4. We would put so much damn C4 in these labs and blow them, you hit that run.
Yeah.
And we'd go run and boom, man, you know, we'd get just far enough where we'd just feel the blast a little bit. Really crazy. I mean, using dynamite that was crystallizing that was left by the local law enforcement, we had to destroy it. So we said, well, let's just
blow
dig
it.
A bigger hole with our cratering charge and let's line it with the dynamite. And, you know, of course you're playing with crystallized dynamite. You shouldn't be doing anything.
That's
with
extremely
it.
Volatile.
Extremely volatile. So, you know, yeah. And we had thermite grenades for engine blocks. You know, you put them on a boat engine there on the Wyaga River, and it would just melt straight through the engine.
Wow. You know,
fascinating. So a lot of things. And then, of course, tragically, I mean, not to go negative or sad, but then people died. And that raised, obviously, the interest in what we were doing. I did it for about 3 years. I did five tours total. I did three in Peru. I did one cadence in Guatemala, and then I did one in Colombia. But it was really, I was sent down there with another agent to determine if jungle operations would be feasible in the Guajira. And of course, you know what the answer to that was?
Not no, but hell no,
absolutely not.
Yeah.
And it was like a 60-day tour I did out of Barranquilla, Colombia. Matter of fact.
Yeah. If you look at the map where the Guajira is, it's a big peninsula that comes up next to Venezuela, and it's desert. And now you talk about Indian country, bad man land, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Terrorist controlled. So, yeah. So that wasn't going to work. But you lost some people, as most people know, plane crashes, Rick Finley, and then the other crash from the other team. So tragic events that keep things in perspective, because I don't care what you're doing or how trained you are, you get loose,
you get a little complacent,
you get complacent, and then moments like that, near misses or moments like that, wake you up and say, wait a minute, listen, this is for real. And matter of fact, I'll tell you a quick jungle story to put it in perspective. We were flying, we were on an operation, and we have host special forces, host country special forces, or national police trained special forces with us on the helicopters. And we're flying along, and all of a sudden on the headsets, the national special forces guys on our helicopter, they're receiving distress signals from a caravan of their special forces that was being attacked by the Shining Path guerrillas, the Sendero Luminoso.
Yeah.
Real time while we're flying. And of course, the pilots are contract, most of them, you know, former CIA type pilot, they've been flying forever, are flying our helicopters. And these guys are saying, listen, we got to go rescue our guys. They're under attack right now. They've been blown up. They're being fired at. Boom. And we weren't that far. And it's like, we cannot get engaged in a domestic situation, the Sendero Luminoso, with national military forces. But guess what? They took their guns. Really? Well, we're going to kill you right here. And we're all going to die if you don't do it. And boom, you know, Jim Kibble was there and he's like, we're in.
Yep.
And boom. And we went in and, you know, it was, I mean, you talk a moment where I was like, we're flying into this and we're coming down and there are massive craters in the ground. There's Jeeps and a deuce and a half have been blown sideways because what they did was they had set up charges in the ground, the Shining Path guerrillas, and timed it where they blew up the trucks and then they assaulted the, you know, the officers. And it was on a little ledge. And on the ledge, it looked like they had called and ordered tents from like some online, green, brown, yellow tents are all set up. So they have been sleeping there waiting for them over the edge of the cliff. And so when we get there, it's still chaos. They're still chasing. There's gunfire. People are chasing people into the jungle because it wasn't really intense jungle. It was like open terrain with trees and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we land, we do infills, and there are people trapped. There are soldiers trapped under their vehicles. There are body parts everywhere. Matter of fact, I remember seeing, looked like a big rock in the road. And I'm like, what's that down there? I go down there and it's actually the trunk of a body, no arms, no legs, blown apart. Of course, got to grab it. You got to be respectful. You know, that's someone's son. And, so Bill Dwyer, I'll never forget, he's got his little Leatherman tool. And we're sitting there. We're like, hurry up. And he's unscrewing the door to the Jeep that had flipped upside down because we couldn't lift it. It was too heavy. So to get to the guy who was inside, you know, and Will DeShazo was our medic, phenomenal, just one of the greatest, another great human being. The whole team's running around. He says, we got the Habies, no, Misha. I mean, just a great team and who are literally secure in the area, and it's just chaos. But we ended up getting a really nice award from the ambassador, which was very nice for getting involved because we were, you know, afraid that might not go so
right. You never knew
so well. We never knew, but it was the right thing to do.
It was. It was a different time. Did you guys have 30 cals in the helos or rocket pods or
no? But we had the machine guns. They weren't 30 cals. They were what are they called? What's the
SMGs?
Bigger. They were the newer. They were prior to the SMG, the big SMGs. You know, the M60s. I'm sorry, M60. Yeah, we had M60 guns.
That's a serious gun
on the helicopters. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So
that's you know what? Yeah. And for our listeners, snowcap, just the training is not for the faint of heart. But then you hear the missions that they go out on. In Bolivia and Peru and Colombia, and I remember Cadence, but I didn't know anything about it. I didn't realize that you guys were in Central America as well. But communist groups everywhere you go, there's insurgents everywhere you go, there's enemies everywhere you go. You know, Colombia itself has a period of its history called La Violencia because it was such a violent country and still is a beautiful country. And I'm certainly not putting it down, but it's just the truth.
Right.
So this is an assignment that. Me being married, there's no way my wife would have gone for it. So I was, and quite honestly, I was having a blast in Miami. We were the Caribbean response group.
But you had your day in Colombia, my friend.
We got there.
As we got there.
Well,
the legendary Steve Murphy. That's the truth.
Legend in my own mind. Just ask
you,
me. To
you and Javier. That was a great operation. I actually was too bad it went away. It was very successful because I think to have effective enforcement, you have to be at the source countries working with the host nationals and be doing domestic enforcement. So it's just the way it is.
And that's a good point. That has been DEA's bread and butter. One of the main reasons DEA has been so successful over the years since its creation was getting in the foreign arena. You know, we still have the largest footprint of federal law enforcement officers. Out of all the U.S. federal law enforcement agencies, DEA still has the largest footprint in the overseas arena. And it pays off in spades. You know, in the United States, if you think this war on drugs is a real war on drugs, just go back and look at it. It's a joke. It's something that politicians, they throw these terms out. It was never a
That's
war.
Right. No.
So you've got to attack it at all the different opportunities, because here in the United States, we're not doing a damn thing to stop.
And with all the agencies.
Yeah.
Everybody working together. I'm a task force guy.
Exactly.
I always was. I always will be. You and I come from, you know, where we worked it. We had control of fusion centers, massive centers comprised of multiple agencies. So we saw how that works and the success of that. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people that didn't believe in that.
Yeah.
So
that Purple Command works. I mean, even the military finally realized it after Grenada.
That's right.
So, anyways.
Hey, players, this is the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, Game of Crimes is now posting interview videos on YouTube. You can find those at Game of Crimes Podcast, and I ask that you click on the subscribe and like buttons. On social media, check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Game of Crimes Podcast and on X at Game of Crimes. Also on Facebook, type in Game of Crimes fan page and join us for some fun. Our website is gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including all our episodes, the book list, which contains the books written by our guests, Game of Crimes merchandise, and more. And for more content, join us on patreon.com/gameofcrimes. I have several monthly episodes that range from silly to serious, so come on over and join the fun. In the meantime, everyone stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.